Jason, I think you're all right, and thanks for being on the show.
An update on what's happening in your Pacific Northwest.
Folks are still pushing back to keep sex offenders out of their community. We'll take you through the latest. Attorney Ethan Blevins will stop by. He helped kill most of the Seattle ordinance, telling landlords that they can't ask tenants, prospective tenants, about their criminal history. So what exactly comes next? He'll explain. Plus, my friend Shannon Bream stops by to break down the latest drama in the possible Trump indictment. You're not going to want to miss what she has to say on this hour of the Jason Rant Show. So let's dive in.
The monologue.
A lot of interesting things happened today as it relates to the wonderful world of, hypocrisy. And of course, if we're talking about hypocrisy, we're talking about it in a political sense. We're, of course, talking about Democrats. In this case, we're, of course, talking about Joe Biden. Now, there seems to be a pretty general consensus, regardless of one's political background, that TikTok poses a direct threat to our security. TikTok as an app, which is owned effectively by the Chinese government. It's not technically owned by the Chinese government, but when you do business in China, the communist government has as much control as they want to leverage on individual businesses. And this is a Chinese company that can gain access to information on your phone when you download their app. And it's become such an issue that folks at different agencies in DC have said that their employees can no longer have the app on their phone. But Joe Biden, as his administration is looking into whether or not they should even ban TikTok, he keeps showing up on TikTok. He does videos on TikTok. And earlier today, a reporter was like, hey, what gives?
You've expressed again today the national security concerns with the app. Why then did the president agree to appear in TikTok videos as recently as, I think, St. Patrick's Day?
Again, we have not changed our national security concerns about the app. It's not for use on government devices, and I don't have anything more for
but
you on that.
Does it send the wrong message if the administration is weighing a ban or could in the future have to weigh it?
We have been very consistent about our concerns over TikTok. There's a CFIUS review underway. I know you want me to tell you more about this, but I'm just not going to get ahead of that.
Ahead of what? That has nothing to do with the question he was asking. He's basically saying, you're telling us it's dangerous, it's bad. Why is Biden on it? It's kind of simple. Now, there is some nuance to this conversation that I think is worth noting. In fairness to the Biden administration, we like to be fair on this show every once in a while. Don't give me that look. It was a joke. There's a difference in the threat, I think, between your 14-year-old kid having it on their phone and a government official. I don't know if the Chinese government is going after your 14-year-old kid's phone. My guess is they're not. It doesn't mean you should let your guard down. It doesn't mean you should allow your kid on TikTok. In fact, I would argue TikTok should be banned just because it's bad for kids. You'll have kids, you'll have adults who are spending hours on TikTok just scrolling and watching these videos. And I put it on one of my old phones it's completely wiped clean. There's nothing on it other than a couple of apps. And I downloaded it and I found myself starting to get addicted to the videos. And I immediately thought, I'm already addicted to the Instagram reels. There's no reason for me to now add TikTok to the mix.
It's the same thing.
It is the same thing, but two of them is worse than one. Because you would think that, Jason, if you're spending an hour on it, probably do 30 minutes and 30. No, well, that means I'll spend 2 hours. That's basically how it would work. So I ended up deleting the app. I still have an account if anyone wants to follow me. There's nothing on it. So there, in fairness to Joe Biden, I do think that there's a little bit of a difference. But the question that, and it was Phil Wegman who was asking that question from Real Clear Politics, there is this move to just completely ban TikTok. And if you're trying to completely ban TikTok in this country, or basically force them to change ownership to an American-owned company so China doesn't have the direct back-end influence that it otherwise would, or at least access to the data, it does seem incredibly hypocritical. What's also hypocritical is a pretty significant story was almost entirely ignored. It came from Fox. They were the only ones who were talking about it, which is the Biden family benefited from Chinese dollars. They did business, the financial documents indicate, with Chinese companies, which again means the Chinese government in a roundabout way, but still. And they benefited financially off of it. The concern is that you've got people like Hunter Biden who uses the Biden name in order to get wealthy. It is curious how wealthy Joe Biden is. He's a career politician. We know exactly the salary he makes. And yet he's doing pretty well. And his son's doing pretty well. No one is talking about it. How often do we hear stories about Donald Trump's kids and how they were benefiting financially? They had a whole bunch of power because of nepotism. Those were big stories. And I think that those were worthy of conversations. But they're just not talking about it in the media. And you ask Karine Jean-Pierre about it, she won't answer any questions, even though Joe Biden himself, I think it was yesterday afternoon or mid-afternoon, came out and said, it's not true. The stories are not true. We've got the documents. We know it's true. That's what the documents seem to point to. But she just won't answer.
House Oversight says they've got bank records showing a Chinese energy company paying three Biden family members through a third party. What were they paid for?
Look, I'm just not going to respond to that.
I'm not going
to
do
here.
It. Look.
We have heard from House Republicans for years and years and years.
She's reading from her script.
How the inaccuracies and lies when it comes to this issue. And I don't even know where to begin to even answer that question, because, again, it's been lies and lies and inaccuracy for the past couple years. And I'm just not going to get into it from here.
OK.
Weird, because you're calling all the other things lies. You said, well, that's a lie, but you're not calling this one a lie. You're saying, well, they lied in the past, so I'm just not going to get into it. Why not just say this is also a lie? That's what Joe Biden did. We know why he's lying. You're the mouthpiece for the White House. You're not going to answer this question? Really? Seriously? Okay. I find it odd that the media is giving them a pass on the one hand. On the other hand, I say, yeah, I kind of expect it. You've got a lot of reporters out there who are Democrat voters, Democrat supporters, and they're going to do anything to help the Democrat Party. They're going to turn on Joe eventually, but we're not there yet.
The interview.
Well, let's be clear. Democrats and the Inslee administration, they're still pursuing this ridiculous and dangerous plan to put sex offenders, dangerous sex offenders, in residential neighborhoods. There was just a town hall in Enumclaw. State Representative Eric Robertson joins me to discuss. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me.
It's an issue that's not just Enumclaw and Sumner, and it's really all of Washington State, given the strategy coming from this administration. It sounds like folks are appreciative of the fact that you guys are trying to at least put some pressure on the Inslee administration, but ultimately this is up to Inslee.
It is indeed. It's Department of Social and Health Services, as well as the Department of Corrections, have both just summarily dismissed our concerns and actual notice to them of violations that fly in the face of not only the court order, but the contracts with the providers that are, you know, housing these sexually violent predators.
What are some of the violations?
Well, the first is the court has been very clear that these individuals can't be around children and others, and they cited this house and gave it a contract that's 453 feet from a elementary school bus stop where children gather every morning to go to school. And that's the first. The second is apparently, and we're working with King County, Councilmember Reagan Dunn, and in King County folks on the issue of the fact that it's on a septic and on a well, and it's only for three bedrooms, and they're proposing to put up to six plus people there. That flies in the face of, you know, any code violation for anything. Additionally, the people that purchased this house did so on a residential loan. This is clearly a commercial for-profit organization. And then lastly, the department time and time again told us, oh, we'll never have someone that was involved in assessing their suitability to be in the community, i.e. the polygraph examiners and psychologists that test the suitability of these sexually violent predators and their ability to be civilly committed in the community. But yet one of the owners of this very house was a polygraph examiner that not only did a polygraph, but did other tests regarding the sexually violent predator that's now living in the house that he is profiting off of.
Wow. Is this just sloppiness? Is this arrogance and not caring about rules or details? How do you explain this kind of behavior?
You know, I'm not going to impugn the integrity of the folks that are administering the program, but definitely sloppy comes to mind. The fact that they didn't know that a school bus stop was directly across the street from this house, information that I gathered with one phone call to the Enumclaw School District, is just sloppy. And the fact that these issues have been raised and presented to them and that they have an obligation to the court and they've summarily just dismissed them and said, oh, we'll take it under advisement, that's arrogance for sure.
So then what is truly the solution here? Is this effectively just a, look, we get the government that we put into office. We get what we deserve. And this is something that can only be fixed at the ballot box or I guess the mailbox.
Well, certainly there's three branches of government for a reason. And, you know, the executive branch, in my opinion, has failed terribly when it comes to this issue. They've not taken the steps to protect the community at large. And that's where our job as legislators comes in, and that is to be the check and balance, if you will, along with the courts on the activities of the executive branch. And so right now we're working with counsel to look at our options. I have a plan that they are reviewing on next steps because, like I say, the Department of Social and Health Services in particular has just ignored us.
Have you gotten any indication that Democrats will stand with you on this? Any?
Well, they're sure not standing up and hearing our bills. I will submit to you that they came in late because this issue came in late because the department snuck this gentleman into our community without any public notice. So it was pressed up against some of our cutoff deadlines. But, you know, we have the ability procedurally to move bills to hearings outside of cutoff with agreement. And we certainly have asked for that. There's a bill that would be regarding the siting of these. And there's also one that we're hoping to fix the public notice for the siting of these LRAs. So the communities aren't caught off guard and having to, you know, hide their children from the house across the street.
It's terrifying. The fact that the work is so sloppy, I'll impugn character. I'm more alarmed if I would rather them just come out and say, yeah, we just don't care about the rules than consider this just sloppy. Because if they're this sloppy on this issue, God knows what they're screwing up beyond that. That's going to have significant safety implications as well.
Absolutely.
It's
and the
terrifying.
Fact is this person doesn't have supervision there. That person has an ankle bracelet and has to phone someone that who knows where they're at when they are going to go to the store or go to a medical appointment or hopefully make it to their treatment appointment. Right now, they're escorted, but, you know, who knows what happens when the escort is no longer there at the house and there's no one there to supervise. So that's very alarming. It's alarming for the neighbors. My constituents are up in arms, and I don't blame them one bit.
Yeah, I would be up in arms myself, and I don't even have kids. State Representative Eric Robertson, he's a Republican from Sumner. Thank you so much for staying on top of this and doing what you can to push back. We really appreciate it.
Absolutely. My pleasure to be here.
Now this.
The monologue. The interview.
Good news, significant legal news coming out yesterday afternoon. Good news for Seattle landlords who no longer have to allow the Seattle City Council and the mayor determine some of whom they will rent their homes to. Joining me on the line is Ethan Blevins. He's a lawyer with the Pacific Legal Foundation that was involved in this case. Welcome back to the show. This concerns a significantly old at this point, at least by new standards, law that was passed, or an ordinance that was passed called the Fair Chance Housing Ordinance. And it basically said a landlord couldn't ask about the criminal background or consider criminal background of a potential tenant, which never made sense, did it?
Right. Yeah. So they couldn't ask. They couldn't use the information. And now the Ninth Circuit has said landlords do, in fact, have a First Amendment right to ask a question and to receive information. Of course, this is public information. Everybody can ask about it. The city asks about it, and landlords have a right to ask about it as well.
Now, the other aspect, though, is that they're not supposed to consider it. Now, I don't know how you prove or disprove that, but what did the court have to say about that?
So, unfortunately, that was sort of the mixed bag here, is that the court said, we don't think landlords have a fundamental right to exclude people, and therefore we don't think that their rights are infringed upon when the city says, oh, you can't consider a person's criminal history when you're deciding whether or not to rent to them. We think that's clearly erroneous. So there's they got it right on the First Amendment issue, whether that's going to be asked about, but then unfortunately got it very wrong on the question whether you can use the information to reject a tenant or to evict a current tenant.
How would one prove that someone considered the criminal background of a potential tenant in declining their application?
Well, the city has said, well, we can't prove it. So that's why we have to, you know, that's why we have to bar the information entirely. I think that it is difficult, especially because, people have a criminal background often have other red flags too, poor credit scores, poor rental history. And those are all legitimate, perfectly legitimate reasons to say under current Seattle law. We'll see if they try to say you can't look at that either. But there's a lot of reasons why you might want to reject somebody who also has a criminal history. So I think it's difficult, which I think speaks to why this is an important win, right? I mean, not that landlords are going to be scofflaws and say I'm not considering that, but there was always this overhanging risk that they're going to think that I rejected so and so because of this. Unfortunately, that still exists with the adverse action provision, but it's possible that the district court now will say, you know, the whole ordinance has to go, even the portion that says you can't consider criminal history. So that's that question of whether just this small portion of the law that prohibits asking the question, whether that just goes away or whether the whole thing is gone.
It just feels like it would invalidate the entirety of it. But again, if you can ask and they acknowledge they can't even prove that you considered it, you know, it's from a practical standpoint, it's a win. But from a legal standpoint, it's not. So let's assume that it moves forward, it gets rid of the ordinance that or the part of the ordinance that says you can't ask, but they still leave it in place. What's the next step for the Pacific Legal Foundation?
I think that we would probably just appeal that specific ruling. This is a doctrine called severability, which is the question whether or not can we just amputate this particular bad part of the law and leave the rest remaining. So that would probably create an issue that we would appeal. I do think it's going to be a while before we get to that because, the city is likely, I think, to appeal the adverse ruling I got from the Ninth Circuit. We haven't decided yet. We may appeal the adverse ruling for our side, which was that, landlords don't have a right to exclude So it's going to be a while before this goes back down to the district court.
Is this something that could ultimately land in the Supreme Court?
I think it's a worthy issue for the Supreme Court for a couple of reasons. And actually the decision that came out the other day kind of highlights this, because unfortunately, when you're speaking about commercial matters or speaking in the context of commerce, the First Amendment doesn't protect you as much than if you were, for example, you know, writing a blog about a political issue. And we've long felt like that's wrong, that when you're speaking and you have a financial interest, you still deserve as much protection than in other contexts like the political context. So that's an issue I think the Supreme Court has been interested in, revisiting this question of whether or not people have full First Amendment rights when they are speaking in the context of a commercial transaction like this. So that's an issue. And I think the Supreme Court has expressed interest in recent years with some property rights cases in this issue of whether or not landlords have a right to exclude somebody. You know, that's a fundamental aspect of someone's property rights. So.
At some point, Democrat leaders decided they're going to fight for felons and degenerates instead of law-abiding business people. It's just absurd when we're told a landlord who maybe themselves were the victim of a rape to then not find out that someone that they're renting to is a rapist. It's especially when all that information you can get otherwise. It's bizarre to me. I don't get it. But I am glad that the Pacific Legal Foundation got involved and they pushed forward with this case. PacificLegal.org is the website to learn more about all of their fights that they're taking on across the country. Ethan Blevins, thank you so much for stopping by. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Jason.
Absolutely. You're listening to The Jason Rant Show.
The Jason Rant Show.
Here to react, Seattle talk radio host Jason Rant.
And the rise of soft on crime laws and policies have made it worse.
Our man in the Pacific Northwest, Jason Rant, is on that.
And you keep on bringing these extraordinary stories from Seattle. It's amazing.
Long form.
When Shannon Bream has a book out, you need to purchase it immediately. And she's got a book out. It comes out next week. It's called The Love Stories of the Bible Speak, Biblical Lessons on Romance, Friendship, and Faith. My friend Shannon Bream joins me now. Welcome back to the show.
I am your number one fan. You know that, Jason.
Thank you. I'm your number one fan. Of course. I always want to have you on the show because you're a brilliant legal mind in addition to knowing your stuff when it comes to the Bible. Let's start with just a big story today. Obviously, there were rumors that there was going to be a grand jury meeting today. Mm-hmm. There was going to be one final witness. But Fox News is reporting not only did that meeting not take place, that DA Alvin Bragg is struggling, at least on one charge, to convince the grand jury that there's enough evidence to indict Donald Trump.
Yeah, and you have to wonder if it is because this of the late witness who came forward, this attorney who says that he had dealings with Michael Cohen. Michael Cohen is out there saying, this guy was never my attorney, but there was some form of waiver, it appears, at some point, signed by Michael Cohen to allow this man to speak about their conversations they've had. So the two dispute a lot of things, but what this newer attorney is saying is that Michael Cohen has not been truthful. He says he went before the grand jury and said, listen, I've got hundreds of emails that I could provide to you. The DA has only showed you six of those. There's much more to the Michael Cohen story that you need to know. So has that testimony thrown a wrench in Alvin Bragg trying to wrap up this case? You know, the optics of it could be that. But now the whole thing seems a little bit tenuous about what comes next.
So it is normal for a DA to withhold certain information in this regard, correct?
Well, yeah. And a grand jury is different. This is not, these aren't the same rules that if you had somebody on the stand and you were following the rules of evidence, it's a little different.
Yeah. So if you could just explain how this process unfolds and why would that attorney be called to testify?
Well, so here's what's interesting is that grand jury proceedings are usually very secret. That's for a lot of reasons, because you want people to come and speak freely. You don't have the same guardrails in place with rules of evidence, that kind of thing. So you want the grand jury to hear all kinds of things from all kinds of different people. The interesting thing in this case is this attorney says, I was watching this from the outside and felt like what I was hearing from this case was not accurate. Things that I was hearing that Michael Cohen had said or other people had said, because a lot of this stuff went public. public. And this gentleman, Mr. Costello, has certainly gone public and talked about what he shared with the grand jury. So absent the witness going out and doing that, everybody else is sort of sworn to secrecy that you're not supposed to talk about what the grand jury hears so that the prosecutors can present the most evidence possible as they're making this initial case.
And they do have access, the grand jury, to the media. I know they're not supposed to
talk
about any of this stuff, but they still have access to everything. And I have to imagine if any of them are doing even a casual review of what some folks are saying, you're even hearing from some Democrats arguing, how do you go to a misdemeanor that couldn't be charged that when the feds looked at it, to Alvin Bragg, and the claim is that he's going to do some felony charge. I think it was a Class E felony. Like, how do you make that jump?
Right. And there are Democrats who are, some of them are now openly saying these things. They've been saying it quietly.
Yeah.
They don't feel like this is the strongest case against the former president. And if this thing is bungled, if a prosecution's brought and it's not a conviction and it looks like then it was purely political, they worry that some of the other cases that could actually be tougher cases for the former president, like what the DOJ is working on or what the Georgia special grand jury is working on, that if Alvin Bragg goes after him and a jury doesn't convict, and they could, but if they don't convict, will it look like it was baseless and political, and will that maybe stunt what they would do out of Georgia or what the DOJ may do?
Yeah.
So there are Democrats who feel like this isn't the strongest of the potential cases, so don't blow it.
And there was probably only one other DA who would be the worst choice to move forward with this would be George Gascon. You've got an Alvin Bragg, not only George Soros back and really plays into everything that – you know, we talk about when it comes to politically motivated DAs not prosecuting. Guy doesn't prosecute misdemeanors. He oftentimes goes easy on felony charges and downgrades them to misdemeanors if they actually do go after misdemeanors. So for this guy to go after Trump in this way, regardless of how anyone feels about Donald Trump, and frankly, even regardless of the facts, the optics are so poor.
Right, because when New York, frankly, is having a bit of a crime wave and you've got shop owners and people who are, you know, defending themselves and then they're the ones that get arrested, you know, people see this, that people are out on bail and they're repeat offenders and they're raping and killing and hurting other people. They have, as you said, the optics of it are really difficult for Bragg's office to say, we're going to downgrade. And they came in and said there are a number of things we're not going to prosecute them anymore, or we're going to be sort of hands off on these situations. So for that to happen, and then, as you said, him to take something that most people would agree is, you know, a misdemeanor issue, try to, you know, charge it up essentially to turn it into a felony after the former president. You know, the optics of it, if nothing else, are difficult because it begins to look political. And again, if the conviction fails, it's only, I think, going to help the former president who has said as much. This is only going to help my numbers.
We're talking with Shannon Bream, host of Fox News Sunday, also the author of the forthcoming book, The Love Stories of the Bible Speak, Biblical Lessons on Romance, Friendship, and Faith. What made you decide to have this topic as the sort of the next chapter of your series of books?
So, you know, our first two books in this series were Women of the Bible Speak, then Mothers and Daughters of the Bible Speak. But really, there were a lot of important guys, men in these stories, too.
Mm-hmm.
And so some of them were really beautiful love stories, like Ruth and Boaz, Mary and Joseph. And they just really modeled a lot of the best things about how we're called to really serve each other, respect each other, love each other. But I wanted to extrapolate that beyond also into friendships and community, because I think we all need that. And we really, over the last couple of years, have struggled. A lot of people feeling very isolated, you know, now coming out of COVID, how do we reconnect with people? You know, and there's this study that shows now that men are having a really hard time forming meaningful friendships. And they just have a hard time being transparent and vulnerable and connecting. And I thought, gosh, there's so much in the Bible that talks about two really solid friendships and people walking literally through, you know, the valley of the shadow of death together. But there's also this part of the Bible that is a little tough because it commands all of us to love our neighbors as ourselves. And the truth is, if we're thinking about ourselves, we're all pretty selfish, if we want to admit it. I know I am. So we're supposed to, you know, lift up other people and give them the same deference and respect. And I think at a time of a lot of division in our communities, it would do us good to remember that we really do have this command to look out for each other.
Yeah, and I think it's so interesting that your books are selling so well, because we've been hearing about the division. We've been hearing about people turning away from God. And yet, I have to imagine you feel good, not just because you're selling these books that you worked really hard on, but you're selling books about religion and about God and about the Bible, and you're bringing people into, you know, a world of spirituality and religion when we're told that no one's really interested in that anymore.
Yeah, and listen, when you look at Pew and you look at Gallup and the way they study this, people are, they're walking away from organized religion. The interesting thing is a lot of people are still believe in God or have an interest in God or in spirituality in their lives, but they're a little bit burned by what they see as organized religion. Or, you know, we see different churches that have struggled with, you know, leaders who have fallen from great heights and people not trusting their religious leaders. So I can understand some of that happening. We had no idea with that first book in the series, Women of the Bible Speak, that there would be such an enormous response to it. And what I found is that during COVID, people were searching. Some people either, if they had walked away from their faith, but they were feeling very lonely and overwhelmed and anxious and fearful, and they wanted to go back to that and see, is that a place I can find peace? And some people who were faithful all along, in writing the books, learned a ton of new stuff about these men and women I thought I knew. And I think others have felt that way. I, you know, got stopped by a man at church a couple weeks ago, literally said to me, hey, my men's group decided to do one of your books as a Bible study because we thought it would be a way to honor our moms, aww, our daughters, our wives, and kind of, you know, more about the characters in the Bible that kind of speak to their challenges and stuff. So I thought that was really sweet.
What challenges, actually, we kind of know the challenges when it comes to organized religion. On the one hand, you have folks who don't want to see their places of worship, regardless of the religion, get too liberal. And I use that in a non-political way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right. And then there are folks who go really, really, really far to the liberal interpretation of scripture, which turns off the other folks who currently are in church. How do you find that middle ground to basically have everyone seem like, or feel like it's approachable?
Yeah, it's really tricky because I saw a guy this morning, one of my friends posted on Instagram, and it really spoke to me. And he was speaking out from the Christian faith. And he said, you know, anytime you put an adjective in front of that, you're making it about something other than Christ. If you're a Christ follower, that you want to do what he says, which is to treat others with respect and to love them and to serve them. The first shall be last, the last shall be first. But they're like, if you put anything in front of Christian, like, oh, I'm a conservative or Republican Christian, or I'm a liberal or progressive Christian, you're really making your faith about something else instead of, you know, for me, there are plenty of great churches in the DC area. Some of them are very political. And I think, listen, there are some things you want your pastor to speak out about where somebody's been abused or there's a human rights issue, of course. But I think a lot of people around here want to go to church and just hear about what the word says. They just want to feel like, okay, there's hope out there. There's peace. We're all looking for that and looking for connection. And so, you know, people can debate all kinds of doctrinal and theological issues. For me, I just try to take it back to the word of God. And there are such amazing stories there that are totally relatable to what we're going through today, whether it's finance or health issues or infertility or widowhood or any number of things. None of that stuff's new. And so God has watched everybody walk through these really tough valleys. And I think by reminding people about those stories in the Bible, hopefully it gives them some encouragement and hope that he knows what's going on in their stories today.
Well, you've got stories that are apolitical in the love stories of the Bible Speak, biblical lessons on romance, friendship, and faith. Shannon Bream, host of Fox News Sunday, thank you so much, as always, for stopping by.
Well, Jason, come back to Fox News Sunday very soon, my friend.
I cannot wait to do that. You're listening to The Jason Rant Show.
The Jason Rant Show.
Let's bring in our man in the Pacific Northwest, KTTH, Seattle talk radio host Jason Rantz. Great to have you with us to tell people a little bit more about this.
Jason Rantz is in focus now.
Jason Rantz, thank you for your reporting on that.
The quick hit.
How's this for a sort of send-off into the real world post-college? A University of Michigan is hosting separate graduation celebrations on the basis of race or sexuality. It's Grand Valley State University. And what's curious about this is, even though it's, you know, this is a story about this one university, these events are happening all around the country at universities large and small, very well-regarded universities and universities and colleges you've never heard of. It's happening just across the board. And in this case, they've got five graduation celebrations that are segregated by race, sexuality, and or gender identity, in addition to just the larger commencement ceremony. It's being put on by the Multicultural Affairs Office. They've got ceremonies for Black students, Asian students, Latinx students, Native American students, and LGBTQIA plus students. On top of that, of course, the large one. Do you go to two of them? They describe the graduation for Latinx students as, quote, an opportunity to come together and acknowledge Laker accomplishments in the spirit and traditions of culture. The Black graduation celebration encourages students to, quote, to celebrate, quote, all that is representative of Black, African-American, and African tradition, heritage, culture, and legacy. And as you can imagine, the same is true of all the other groups. Just we'll celebrate our own culture. It, to me, continues to send the wrong message that any of this is necessary, that you can't feel comfortable, you know, celebrating whatever it is you want to celebrate as part of a larger group, that we actively say you should feel uncomfortable around other people. That's what you're saying here. That's exactly what you're saying. You can't celebrate some culture when a white person is around or when another racial minority is around that's different from you. That if you're a Latinx student, which doesn't exist, that's not a word, that you should feel uncomfortable celebrating your culture around Black people. And what culture is being celebrated? Is it American culture? Is it Latino American culture? African American culture? Or is it celebrating a culture which you don't really have any direct connection to as you would is if you lived there? So if you're getting together and you're doing Mexican culture, I don't understand what it is they're trying to celebrate and why it is that you have to set aside a group of people for what's basically separate but equal accommodations. Why do we have to keep reminding people this is wrong? And the fact that this happens at a time in which these students are graduating, so they're 21 years old, 22, to me, this indicates, because I haven't read any pushback in any meaningful way from students on campus, although we've heard a little bit of let's just call it grumbling, but most of it has been happening outside of the school. If you're okay with this at 21, 22, it's because when you were in high school and even younger, you were told that this was okay. A lot of the indoctrination has been going on, and most of us didn't realize it was as bad as it was until COVID, because COVID allowed so many parents to get a glimpse at what was being taught to their kids. I mean, just think about that. That was the only positive that came out of remote learning. It opened the floodgates for parents to actually hear, literally hear, what was being taught. But that had been going on in a different way, and maybe using different language, but it was going on before COVID. And it created students like the ones at this Michigan University who think that this is okay. And again, it's not to pick on this university. I've never heard of this university. I've never heard of it. Grand Valley State University. But I have heard of Harvard. I have heard of Columbia University. Both of them did exactly the same thing. They might have been called something else, but they did the same thing, the same race-based and gender identity or sexuality-based celebrations of an achievement that we shouldn't have to separate. We should celebrate it as a large group, because you all have – that's the thing. When you graduate college, you all went through pretty much the same journey. There are some obvious differences depending on your major, but you went through college – you had your struggles, you had your academic struggles, you had your maybe economic struggles, just trying to put yourself through school. You faced all of these hurdles that you overcame, and you all overcame them, and it should have been a celebration for all. But instead, we separated out. Now, would you ever do a celebration, a ceremony for straight white men or straight white women? No, of course not. Rightly so. But the person who calls that racist will then defend a black-only celebration, a Latino-only celebration, Native American-only celebration. You cannot explain why one is racist and the other is not beyond leaning into a political position, and it is a political position, about oppressors and the oppressed. That's the only space that you can make an argument. It's not a good argument, but at least you can argue it. But you can't argue that this isn't racist. Sorry, you can't use this water fountain. This one is for blacks only. That one is for Asians only. Well, we would never do that for whites anymore. That was a stain on our history, and yet we're going directly back to that, and it's sad. It's more sad that we're doing it towards younger kids. We've had several conversations on this show about local high schools and middle schools. The indoctrination is strong. What's funny, it's somewhat separate from this, but along the lines of the same kind of indoctrination, we did a story about a week ago on a middle school teacher over at Redmond Middle School. And he was ripping into Fox, and he said to the students he knew that what he was about to do was wrong, but he did it anyway. And he rips into Fox, and the whole intent was to rip into conservative media and Donald Trump. That's what they do. That's all that these teachers do. That was the intent. Sure, this one had to do with just Fox News, but I guarantee you the teachers who pull this kind of stuff, they're doing this towards all Republicans. They're doing it towards Trump. They're doing it towards DeSantis. And they're doing it in front of a group of kids who can't leave. This case, a couple students complained and their parents complained. But over the course of the last couple days, I've been getting emails, I'm assuming from middle schoolers in his class, this teacher's class. Leave my teacher alone. He can talk about whatever it is he wants to. Leave him alone. Like, I'm getting a lot of those emails, which makes it seem like it's coordinated. Don't know by who. Don't know if it's by the teacher or a parent or some precocious young kid who said, hey, let's all email Jason Rantz. The fact that you've got kids fighting on behalf of a teacher who's indoctrinating them just kind of tells you the point about the dangers of this kind of indoctrination. You're listening to The Jason Rantz Show.